And so the background for this is actually seeing psychoanalytic basic principles as basic science and a way of thinking about how do we help people. So for me, this combination of curiosity and justice and equality and alleviating of suffering came together in a very powerful way around this work.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Marins. Dr. Marins is a child and adult psychoanalyst at the Yale School of Medicine, where he's the Harris Professor of Child Psychoanalysis and Professor of Psychiatry, and Director of the Childhood Violent Trauma Center at the Yale Child Study Center. This work will be the focus of our interview today. Dr. Marins has devoted much of his career to developing and implementing psychoanalytically informed responses to children, families, and communities traumatized by violent and catastrophic events, including mass casualty school shootings and natural disasters. He has developed model approaches to enhance developmentally informed police practices and police mental health collaborative approaches to those impacted by traumatic events. And he is the co-developer of an early, brief, evidence-based treatment that has been demonstrated to interrupt and prevent the development of PTSD. Let me repeat that because it's quite significant. He is the co-developer of an early, brief, evidence-based treatment that has been demonstrated to interrupt and prevent the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. Quite significant. These intervention models continue to be widely implemented in the United States and abroad. Additionally, Dr. Marins has consulted extensively with local, state, and federal leaders, as well as news media regarding policy and practices that best address childhood trauma. As you will hear in today's interview, Dr. Marins has immersed himself in the developmental processes that are affected by trauma. And as I mentioned, he has developed these interventions that can be life-changing for the children, for the families, and for communities. Here is my interview with Dr. Stephen Marins. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
When one thinks of psychoanalysis, one doesn't ordinarily then think of public health initiatives, police force collaborations, and working with kids in the community who've been overwhelmed by trauma. But that's, in fact, just what you've created. You've created a public health initiative that has had an impact around the country. You've worked closely with the New Haven Police Department. You've taken call with them. You've learned from them. They've learned from you. And you've worked with children who have been faced by unspeakable trauma, and you've helped it become spoken. And these are kids who would otherwise never see the inside of an analyst's office, would never get the benefit that an analytically trained person can bring to this work. Frankly, to my reading of what you've done, it's really nothing short of revolutionary. Can you share with our audience, some of whom will know about your work and many will not, can you share your vision for this work and where your program has started out and where it is now?
So I think the vision is based on a long and rich history within psychoanalysis, both in the consulting room and ways in which what we've learned in the consulting room has been applied. So when I think about our work, and I think about psychoanalysis, I think that one of the key ingredients has to do with the attention to close observation. As some of my predecessors experienced, that the closer we get to phenomena, the more we're in a possible place to apply what we know about details of human experience to shared details that human beings share across multiple dimensions. So I think about the work of Anna Freud during the war and all that was learned about housing children who'd been evacuated from the East End. She and her colleagues learned an enormous amount by seeing up close and personal the impact of children's separations from their parents in conditions that were quite dire and life-threatening. Think about the work of my colleagues Al Solnit and Joe and Sonny Goldstein, who applied what we knew about development in the context of custody and placement issues and developed the best interests of the child principles. And so the background for this is actually seeing psychoanalytic basic principles as a basic science and a way of thinking about how do we help people. With the issues of violent trauma and other catastrophic circumstances, the challenge for me as a psychoanalyst was doing my work with individual patients, but also knowing the impact of failures of recovery from traumatic experience. But the number one, the volume of kids who are experiencing horrific events in their lives on a regular basis, and the unlikely possibility that they would ever come into my consulting room is what really inspired our attention going to kids that we knew about in our own community and then would learn our kids in communities around the country. These are kids who are exposed to domestic violence and sexual abuse and physical abuse and shootings and robberies and other forms of violence that are happening in their neighborhoods. Question was, if we're not seeing them in our consulting room, who sees them on a regular basis? And one of the answers is that police are one of the few professions that still make house calls 24/7. And so we reached out to folks in the New Haven Police Department at a time where they were going through a revolution, thinking that they were not going to arrest their way out of the violence that they were contending with, particularly at the height of violence associated with crack cocaine trade in the early 90s. And they were ready and looking to partners with whom they might work to think about new ways of intervening on behalf of children and families exposed to violence, and to think differently about interrupting the cycle, exposure to violence, to failures in development and subsequent outcomes that will often bring the police back into the lives of families that they have previously visited on emergency calls. That was the starting point.
You know, you describe the interest of the police department. I've never worked with police departments, so this is all new to me. What was it like for you? I've read your work and you've taken calls with them. You've gone out into traumatic situations. You've seen the results of it, the kids that are exposed. What happens when you work with them? What kind of reception do you feel from them? What kind of interest? How accepting are they of you and your way of thinking?
Well, now after 28 years of working with our colleagues in New Haven, and this has been the experience of other similar partnerships that are based on the work that we developed, but I'm smiling as you asked the question, Harvey, because I was thinking about the experience of the brand new psychiatric resident who has a consultation liaison assignment and quickly finds out that they are often not greeted by the folks who are working on the floor as the savior that they might like to be with troubled patients. And so in many ways, one of the first lessons was giving up this myth and this idea that because we were so deeply trained in the details of human functioning and behavior and motivation, that we were somehow going to be the manna from heaven to our police colleagues. And so one of the first things that we learned was they didn't know us from Adam. Most of us knew nothing about policing. And so the first approach was to actually learn from them by spending time with them and they with us. The first reception, I'll never forget one of the first ride-alongs I ever did. I was assigned to a young woman who apparently had some interest in psychology, and she was told by her supervising sergeant that she was going to have the civilian rider. And we went from job to job, and finally we came to a motor vehicle stop, and there was a small accident, and a number of other police units had responded. She got out of the car. I didn't know what to do, so eventually I got out of the car, and I walked over. And another officer who didn't know me looked at me and said, "Sir, could you move along?" And I pointed at the other cop, the young woman, and I said, "Well, I'm with her." And he kind of looked at me up and down, and he turned around and he walked away. The police work in a world that most civilians are never going to see, certainly not in their professional work. And as a result of the work they do, people like me at first were outsiders who didn't belong. One of the ways that we broke through that was by learning from each other, by spending a lot of time with each other, and by demonstrating our willingness not only to learn, but to respond shoulder to shoulder in situations that were their bread and butter, but not very palatable bread and butter. And so to show up in the middle of the night when we would get a call because there had been a murder or serious sexual assault or a beating, indicated that we were willing to work with them, not for them, not as a referral source, but to work with them and to learn from them. And this changed the nature and the development of a partnership. And what we learned as a result was that not only a great deal about the details of the potential role that officers can play in initiating recovery from acute traumatic experience, but it also put us in a position to learn in much, much greater detail about some of the phenomena associated with different phases of trauma response. And this then really led to the development of what became a program.
And this is the Child and Family Traumatic Stress Intervention Program, yes?
No, this is the Child Development Community Policing Program.
I see.
In which what developed actually grew out of what happened quite naturally, which was all of the police officers in New Haven and in other cities and communities where this work has been done are trained in fundamental principles of human development, psychodynamic principles of human development, trauma in the context of community policing, and all clinicians are trained in basics of police activity, learning, you know, the basics about probable cause, use of force, arrest policies, and to get a feel for what it's like to be in the office of a police officer, which is in their squad car on the scene of events to which they're responding. And part of that program also included being on call 24/7, available to either respond on scene or to provide consultation and to brainstorm about disposition planning acutely, and then to do follow-up planning in terms of what coordinated responses as well as clinical responses might be indicated in each of the cases that come up.
Can you walk us through an example of, so you're in the police car or you're called or someone from your team is called and there's been a murder, let's say, and there are kids exposed. And so give us a step-by-step of how you and the people on your team will go with the police and encounter the victims and the survivors and how you actually engage with all the people involved.
First of all, I'll give an example where it happened a few months ago where an 11-year-old boy was playing on a basketball court, a bunch of other kids, and there was a shooting that occurred. Someone fired shots from a car and struck and killed the young man who was very close to the basketball court on which the 11-year-old boy was playing. I got a call from the scene commander, was asked to come to the scene, particularly in order to meet with this 11-year-old and his mother. And there were two purposes. One is that they were very concerned about this child's well-being, his having just witnessed this shooting. And they were also aware that he was quite quiet and withdrawn in their attempts to talk to him about what he might have seen. And so I went with one of the responding officers. We went to the boy's home. They were expecting us. The mother had been asked permission and asked if she would like to have somebody from the Child Study Center come and meet with them. She agreed, and the officer and I went to the home. And The first part was simply being introduced, telling them a bit about what we do and why we do it. In that context, being able to say to both the boy and his mother that when things like this happened, it can really shake up the way we feel and think, how our bodies feel, how our minds are working, and that there are some ways of helping them to understand what's happening and some ways of thinking about how to become the boss again of those feelings and experiences. The boy was first looking away, not able to make eye contact. But eventually, as I began asking about where he went to school, favorite classes, etc., I could then ask, so tell me, given what we were saying about scary events and impact, what are you feeling in your body right now? I, you know, pointed to his heart. I said, what are you feeling right there? What are you feeling in your stomach? And he was able to say that his heart was beating very, very fast and his stomach was tied up in knots and he felt like he was going to vomit. And at that point, I was able to explain a little bit about what was going on with his body and how it was a natural reaction. And then I taught him focused breathing, a very simple but very effective way of turning down the volume on noradrenergic dysregulation, increases heart rate, changes respiration, etc. And I first taught him, and he was able to practice it with me a few times. And I asked him, so how are you feeling? And he got this smile on his face. He says, oh my goodness, I feel a bit better. And then I asked him to teach his mother the same technique. And the purpose of that was to help him not only feel more in control by turning the volume down on his very unpleasant, activated, aroused feelings, but then to be the master of it and to teach his mother. And so in a case like that, this was a boy who was now more engaged, was actually quite ready and eager to give whatever information he could to the investigating detective who then joined us. And in follow-up, we always follow up. We set up an appointment with the boy and his mother for them to have a more formal evaluation several days later of where he was at in terms of his symptoms, his experience, what he was observing, what the mother's observing, and then to introduce our brief early intervention, which is the child and family traumatic stress intervention. In this case, it consists of, it's about 5 to 8 sessions, and it involves a, first of all, screening of a systematic approach to screening, of symptoms, and then getting the mom's point of view, in this case, the 11-year-old boy's perspective, and being able to literally compare notes. And then we meet with the mother to get a snapshot of developmental history, we think is important in terms of the dynamics of development and current functioning, as well as checking in and doing a systematic evaluation with the mom about how she's doing in terms of her own symptomatology. Because frequently when these events happen, parents are often aroused. We also do what's called a trauma history questionnaire, where we talk to both the mother about her own history as well as the child's history in order to think about what the connections might be, what might be revisited, where the vulnerabilities might be because of previous experiences. And the starting point for this is really informing and having a discussion about what do we even mean by trauma? What is it that changes in the way we think and feel when something overwhelming and unanticipated happens? We have a similar meeting with the child separately, but then we bring the two together and we literally compare notes, because one of the findings is that frequently there's an enormous discrepancy between what parents are seeing and what their children are reporting and vice versa. This is an opportunity to increase the communication, but first helping both to articulate and identify the specific areas in which the symptoms are occurring.
Let me ask you a question about that. I imagine that what I'm about to ask isn't something that you would necessarily speak about with either the child or the mother, but I'm noticing the absence of any reference to a father. And here you come in as a father figure, if you will, and you ask him how he feels. And you not only ask him how he feels, but you obviously, in a very attuned way, assume that he feels things somatically, at least initially. So you address how he feels in his body. Well, that's obviously a very powerful intervention for this young boy to have from a man. He may not have had a man ask him how he feels before in his life. Do you see that as playing a part in both the family system and the individual psychology of these kids?
I think initially that may play less of a role than the opportunity for the child and the parent to actually get some auxiliary help in structuring and identifying and locating the sources of their distress or the forms of their distress. So in this particular case, it happens there was not a father on the scene, and the possibility that my being a man played a role, that's possible. I think far more powerful is actually helping to equip people at a time when their own capacities to distinguish and articulate experience is at its lowest ebb, when there is such a level of dysregulation in both cognitive, affective, and somatic experience. So I think that that becomes really key. And then what's even more important is the ability for the child and the parent to be able to speak the same language, to begin to make observations. For example, that when a child is being irritable in the aftermath of such an event or being more oppositional, that it's not just the child being bad. It's not just the child being angry. It may be a sign and an indication that both parent and child can now recognize as a demonstration of some of the anxious, aroused feelings kicking in. And then to help them identify what are the circumstances and what differently can they do instead of the more behavioral counterproductive enactments.
The self-awareness that you're inviting them to consider and that you're modeling for them. Yeah.
Exactly. Self-observing capacity is absolutely key. And as we know in our consulting rooms, as well as when we're in somebody's home in these circumstances, increasing not only the individual's self-observing capacity, but getting them support in doing that when they're less able is one of the keys to recovery.
I imagine, I'm trying to picture the scene you're describing and the interventions you're describing, and I would imagine both the mothers and the children would get quite attached to you. And I wonder how, when you, because these are brief interventions, so I assume, how it goes when you remove yourself from the involvement with them.
I think that's a wonderful question. And again, because so much of the focus is really enhancing the parents and the child's capacity to help each other, that becomes much more of a focus. And one of the things that's really quite striking, because this intervention has been demonstrated to be enormously effective in not only alleviating suffering post-traumatically, but also interrupting and preventing the continuation.
Which is obviously huge. And this important empirical data that I'd love you to share with us. But yes, yeah.
Right. So what I was going to say about the connection is that one of the things that's really quite really astounding and has been astounding to me is how well kids and families do, many of them. And when they don't do so well, the other function that CFTSI, the Child and Family Traumatic Stress Intervention, plays is as an assessment tool. And so for many of the kids we see, we're able for the first time, this may be the first behavioral health contact they've ever had. And for some kids, we discover that there are lots of areas that they've been struggling with prior to this most recent precipitating event. And what we're finding is that those kids, when the recommendation for further treatment is indicated, those families are much more likely to take up the recommendation. And in those cases, yes, often the person who's been doing the CFTSI is the person they want to continue to work with because the connection is established and there's already been an experience of mastery as a result of the work together.
Going back to your reference to Anna Freud and the war, where she appreciated how vital is the parent's response in terms of how it influences the child, I assume you see that as well.
Absolutely. And this is true in any of the major changes that and one of the major applications of psychoanalytic principles have been seen when these kinds of observations have been made. It's the same is true with Edith Jacobson and and the Joyce and James Robertsons around the rooming in policies in hospitals, recognizing that separating children from their parents when they need to be in hospital or when the parent needs to be in the hospital is deleterious to development. So yes, the notion of the role of the parents as a mediator is something that's central to our understanding of normal development that we capitalize on in any therapeutic endeavor that we engage in with kids and parents.
And your model, you've applied your model in situations other than community policing. You've in natural disasters, 9/11. Can you tell us a bit about where this has been useful?
Yeah, and just to add that the same approach that we've taken with the police is one that we've taken with Child Protective Services and colleagues in our pediatric emergency room, et cetera. But one of the things that we've learned is not only about the individual experience, but the aggregation of individual experience when an entire community is impacted by a catastrophic event. We were very involved, and along with Steve Southwick, a colleague at the VA hospital in New Haven, and I co-led along with Carrie Epstein, co-developer of CFTSI, we co-led Yale's response to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings. And there we were involved with meeting with community members, with professionals, healthcare providers, et cetera. And one of the things that we did was recognize that the closer things are to home, the more impacted we are personally, even if we have professional roles to fill. And this is a time where we want to capitalize on the relationships that already exist within the community. And so one of the things that we did was we went in and we trained internists, pediatricians, folks at the hospital, as well as psychotherapists, mental health professionals, in what are some of the more acute intervention strategies that can be useful to families and to adults in the immediate aftermath of such a horrible event. We also then became very involved in the Sandy Hook Elementary School. One of my younger colleagues was actually embedded in the classroom of kids who were next door to where the other children were murdered, and worked for a number of months, several days a week in the classroom. And we were also seeing kids and families in our early intervention and for some longer-term treatment. One quick example of that impact and that experience was very powerful for lots of reasons, but we were meeting with parents of the surviving children and who were, you know, had just gone through hell, not only hiding, but then having to scramble around bodies strewn in the hallway. And here they were coming back to school. Parents, many of these kids were in the school, you know, the entire day, constantly checking in. And we met with them, Carrie and I met with these parents, the group of parents, and we were talking about some of the impact and what was going on in terms of human responses to overwhelming events, and how important it was, for example, to reestablish routines, and that the parents would be seen as beacons of current safety and the current reality. And at one point, this father sheepishly, I have permission to use this story, so sheepishly raised his hand and he said, "So you mean that when my six-year-old every night has been asking for chocolate ice cream for dinner, I shouldn't be saying yes?" And around the room, people smiled with tears running down their cheeks because it resonated with the extent to which parents were bending over backwards to help their children in ways that actually weren't helpful. Like going to the classroom every 10 minutes to check in. It was not helpful. It wasn't reassuring. But another part of the story was a little girl who actually was in our early brief intervention. And she went into the classroom, and one of the things kids were struggling with were traumatic reminders. Every time there was a crackle over the PA system or there was a closing of a door, kids would literally be diving to the floor or in paroxysms of tears and upset. And this little girl raised her hand and said, "I know what can help." She said, "This is what I learned from my therapist. She said, it feels like our bodies aren't in control anymore, and I know a way to make us bosses again. She taught them, she both explained why people were having a reaction, and then she taught them focused breathing with the help of the psychology colleague who was in the classroom. It was really quite powerful.
That's quite something. Stephen, the work is really moving and vital, and yet not many analysts do this kind of really in the community work. Can you share with us a bit about yourself? What brought you to this?
Well, I guess the whole notion of being curious is one angle. I'm told that from the time I was very little, I had the curse and the blessing of being exquisitely sensitive to other people, to other kids. And I think in many ways that drove my curiosity about what makes people tick. I also grew up in a home, an analytic home, in which both of my parents were steeped in both their clinical work, but also in applications. My father was very involved with Reg Lurie and Al Solnit and Sam Rutbo, friends and colleagues later of mine, in some of the earliest days back in the 60s of thinking about how can we intervene in the cycle of poverty and developmental deprivation that so many overstimulated kids were experiencing in the poorest of our communities. And they were very involved in going around the world and learning about early childcare. It was part of the birth of the daycare movement. My parents were also very involved in the civil rights movement and in politics. And so for me, this combination of curiosity and justice and equality and alleviating of suffering came together in a very powerful way around this work. And I do remember as a college student sitting in the stacks and reading volume paper by Freud and thinking, oh my goodness, he knows something about me. In other words, he was articulating phenomena that allowed me to feel less alone and also to have a purchase on there being some logic to some of my own experiences. And in many ways, the work we do with our police colleagues, our colleagues in the emergency department, et cetera, but most important with the children and families we work, is to provide a similar purchase in which the ability to first understand what's going on with oneself is the most necessary platform to believing that there are alternatives to the way that one's experiencing even the worst of situations.
You share with the police and the children and the mothers that gift that you felt understood when you read Freud, and that there was sense to be made of this, and now you pass it on. It's quite lovely.
Yeah, I think the other piece is listening. It's an extraordinary thing, the number of cops who we first thought were going to be hard-bitten and not interested, and many of them weren't, but really, really quite fascinating to begin to understand why it was so familiar in their experience to turn a blind eye away from the suffering that was right in front of them, to clear the scene as soon as they can after a domestic or a violent situation, even if there were kids there. And in many ways, what I came to understand and deeply appreciate is that that makes all the sense in the world, because if you feel helpless in the face of the worst realization of our worst shared human nightmare scenarios, then of course we turn away. But if we can equip each other and actually no longer feel alone in bearing the burden of addressing problems, but actually know how to address them, then it allows the blinders to come on. And for many cops, the work together was the first time that anybody was saying, what's it like for you? And it was the first time where they were no longer alone in going into the most horrific scenes, but now had partners. And I must add, Harvey, that so importantly, that the work that we do, including a central piece of trauma treatment, is ensuring that the danger no longer exists. It's about putting the past in its proper place. But if the danger still exists, then no matter how smart we are, we need partners to help ensure that. And lastly, cops play a critical role in being able, you mentioned earlier the father figure, but cops represent authority in a way that when it is benign authority, attentive authority, listening authority, when it's serving an auxiliary ego function, cops are a tremendously powerful role in helping people not only feel safe physically, but in being able to find grounding in a safer reality when that can actually occur. And for that reason, we've taken what we've learned and we've now developed a toolkit and a training in partnership with the International Associations of Chiefs of Police and the U.S. Department of Justice that's now being disseminated broadly to law enforcement agencies around the country so that cops who are working even without partnerships with mental health professionals feel better equipped to play a role in initiating the recovery of kids and families to whom they respond.
Well, that's what I meant by you've created a public health initiative that extends far beyond just New Haven. It really has had an influence around the country.
Well, we're working on it.
You know, I'm sitting with that picture of you, college student, in the library reading Freud and feeling, if I heard you right, listened to, less alone, and understood. And I'm seeing all the goodness that's come from that in terms of you're offering it to struggling kids, police departments, mothers, the field. It's really, I said at the beginning, it was revolutionary. It really is revolutionary. And I'm grateful through this experience of this interview to have read your articles, which will be connected to this podcast at the bottom for our listeners to read, because they're very important and they're beautifully clear and they're powerful. And so I thank you for that. I thank you for this. I look forward to our keeping in touch because we in Philadelphia certainly need this kind of input. And I'm sure many people listening to this around the country and around the world will also be drawn to learn from your hard-learned skills. So thank you.
Well, Harvey, thank you. I'm also grateful to the opportunity to talk with you. And I'm also extraordinarily grateful to have had the opportunity to learn so much from the kids and families with whom we worked. Many years ago, I had a wonderful teacher and colleague in Sally Province, who was a pediatrician and a psychoanalyst at the Child Study Center many years ago. And she was supervising me on a case involving a severely sexually abused little boy who was giving me a run for my money and sometimes making me run and chasing after him after he'd kick or spat or whatever in the consulting room. And I remember going to her with some degree of despair and saying, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to help this kid. And Sally, in her wonderful, patient way, first listened. And then she said something that always stayed with me. She said, you know, in the midst of a tragedy, if we learn just one thing that could help that individual who's gone through the tragedy, and we can learn from them ways of helping others who go through similar tragedies, then it's not only a tragedy. So the work that we've done with thousands of kids and families over the years, I am enormously grateful to them for all that they've taught me and my colleagues about how to better improve the outcomes of people who are not in control of the worst nightmares coming true. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.